Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Around 90% of adolescent girls and young women do not use the internet in low-income countries, while their male peers are twice as likely to be online, the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, said on Thursday. To mark International Girls in Information and Communication Technologies Day, UNICEF stressed that closing the digital divide between girls and boys was about more than just having access to the internet and technology. It's about empowering girls to become innovators, creators, and leaders, said UNICEF Director of Education, Robert Jenkins. On average, across 32 countries and territories, girls are also 35% less likely than boys to have basic digital skills, such as being able to send emails or transfer files. To bridge the digital gender gap, UNICEF says that girls need early exposure and access to technology, digital and life skills training, equal access to mentoring and internships in the digital sector, and policies to better protect girls' safety online. So-called labor transfer and vocational training programs in the Tibet Autonomous Region of China could lead to forced labor conditions, UN-appointed independent human rights experts warned on Thursday. The experts, including Tomoya Obokata, special rapporteur on contemporary forms of slavery, said that hundreds of thousands of Tibetans have been reportedly transferred from their traditional rural lives to low-skilled and low-paid employment since 2015. In practice, their participation has reportedly been coerced, the experts said. They also noted the labor transfer programs focus on cultural and political indoctrination in a militarized environment, with participants reportedly prevented from using their minority language and discouraged from expressing their religious identity. The experts called on the Chinese authorities to clarify the conditions for opting out of the programs, to monitor working conditions, and to ensure respect for Tibetan religious, linguistic, and cultural identity. They are in contact with the Chinese government on the issue. A new law in the United Kingdom is incompatible with the country's international obligations on people's rights to freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, and association. That's the message from UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, who on Thursday called the UK's recently passed Public Order Act deeply troubling. The UN rights chief maintained that it imposes disproportionate restrictions on the exercise of key rights, notably by expanding the powers of the police and imposing criminal sanctions on people involved in peaceful protests. As the world faces the triple planetary crises of climate change, loss of biodiversity, and pollution, governments should be protecting and facilitating peaceful protests on such existential topics, not hindering and blocking them, he said. The UN rights chief stressed that the law's apparent targeting of those protesting about human rights and environmental issues is particularly concerning. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Well, what kind of day are you having? I mean, it could be anything, actually, with you. I mean, you're out there working on a Thursday. You know, it's throwback Thursday, as they say. I always wondered, what does that mean, throwback Thursday? I'm always trying to put that together. I haven't figured that out yet. Does it mean classic rock and roll? Or, I don't know, some ancient history day. Anyhow, we got Law and Disorder coming up here after Democracy Now. And it's a beautiful 64 degrees here, partly cloudy.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Sudan, fighting continues between the army and paramilitary rapid support forces despite a U.S.-brokered 72-hour ceasefire, with airstrikes reported in the capital Khartoum and deadly battles in Darfur. Residents and foreign nationals have become increasingly desperate to leave the most dangerous hotspots and worsening shortages of food, water, and medical care. The White House said Wednesday, a second U.S. citizen, a Sudanese-American doctor, was killed in the conflict. While the U.S. successfully evacuated its diplomatic personnel soon after fighting broke out April 15th, an estimated 16,000 Americans, many of them dual citizens, still remain in Sudan this week, though it's unclear how many of them want to leave. Concern is growing that violence against Sudanese citizens will escalate after foreign nationals are evacuated. Tens of thousands of people have fled Sudan to neighboring neighboring countries, including Chad, which already hosts more than 500,000 refugees. This is a Sudanese mother, now at a refugee camp in Chad.
Armed men came to our compound and asked us to leave before we became collateral victims. Under threat, we left in a hurry in a donkey to come here. I got separated from my 7 children and I can't find them. We have seen parents massacred by Arab militias while they have done nothing. We are victims of gratuitous barbarism that we do not understand.
Ukraine's government says one person was killed and 23 others wounded after Russia's Navy launched 4 missiles from the Black Sea, striking residences in the city of Mykolaiv. Elsewhere, a Ukrainian journalist working for the Italian La Repubblica newspaper was shot dead Wednesday on the outskirts of Kherson in southern Ukraine. The newspaper reports Russian snipers killed Bogdan Bitik, who was working as an interpreter, and wounded Italian reporter Corrado Zunino. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports at least 15 journalists have been killed in Ukraine since Russia invaded. On Wednesday, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky held his first talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping since Russia's invasion of Ukraine last year. China's foreign ministry said after the phone call, it would dispatch former Chinese ambassador to Russia, Li Hui, as a special envoy to Kyiv to find a political settlement to the war.
China always stood on the side of peace on the Ukraine issue. China advocates political settlement of the crisis and promotes talks for peace.
Officials with both NATO and Russia welcomed Wednesday's phone call, but NATO leader Jens Stoltenberg criticized China for not condemning Russia's invasion. In Russia, the jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny said Wednesday he's facing additional charges of terrorism in Russia that could bring him a life sentence. Navalny, visibly gaunt, rejected the charges while speaking via video link from prison during an appearance before a Moscow court. Navalny's microphone was cut after he alluded to his time spent in solitary confinement. President Joe Biden has pledged to deploy nuclear-armed submarines to South Korea and to include officials from Seoul and nuclear planning operations targeting North Korea. Biden made the pledge Wednesday as the White House hosted the South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol for a state visit, marking 70 years of the U.S.-South Korean alliance. This is President Yoon.
Our two leaders have decided to significantly strengthen extended deterrence of our two countries against North Korea's nuclear and missile threats so that we can achieve peace through the superiority of overwhelming forces and not a false peace based on the goodwill of the other side.
As part of the agreement, President Yoon renewed a pledge not to pursue the development of South Korean nuclear arsenal. Turkish authorities have arrested at least 110 pro-Kurdish activists, journalists, and lawyers in a series of raids across 21 Turkish provinces. The arrests come just weeks ahead of a May 14th parliamentary and presidential election, which could see President Recep Tayyip Erdogan extend his 20-year rule. Erdogan canceled scheduled campaign rallies this week for health reasons. Turkey's government accused those arrested of having ties to the Kurdish Workers' Party, known as the PKK, which Turkey claims is a terrorist group. On Capitol Hill, House Republicans have narrowly approved a bill to raise the debt limit in exchange for a 13% cut in discretionary spending. The legislation also caps spending over the next decade, blocks the White House's student debt relief plan, slashes funding to the IRS, and blocks tax credits for renewable energy projects like wind and solar. It also imposes work requirements on able-bodied adults up to 55 years old in order to receive Medicaid or SNAP. That's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. New York Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said Wednesday Congress should instead reverse Trump-era tax cuts that overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy and are set to increase the federal deficit by $1.9 trillion over a decade.
This isn't just about continued cuts to the poor and to the working class in our essential services, but we can raise revenue. In fact, in tax cuts in 2017 passed by the other side of the aisle, we see wonderful tax cuts for yacht owners and private jets. But in order to balance our budget now, we're talking about cuts to SNAP, to food out of babies' mouths, instead of actually reexamining the inequities within our tax system.
Senate Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called the House bill dead on arrival in the Senate. Without a deal on the debt ceiling, the U.S. could default on its bills as soon as June. Oklahoma's Pardon and Parole Board has denied clemency to death row prisoner Richard Glossop, even though Oklahoma's own attorney general has sought to vacate Glossop's 1998 murder conviction. On Wednesday, the board voted 2-2 to deny clemency despite widespread doubt over Glossop's guilt. An execution date has been set for May 18th. We'll have more on the story after headlines. Montana's Republican-controlled House of Representatives voted Wednesday to censure the state's first and only openly transgender lawmaker, Zoe Zephyr, banning her from the House floor, forbidding her from speaking. Zephyr will only be able to cast votes remotely for the remainder of the legislative session. The move comes a week after Zephyr delivered a searing condemnation of a bill that would ban gender-affirming health care for youth and after her supporters led a protest inside the state capitol Monday. Zephyr has since been largely silenced on the House floor after the Republican House Speaker demanded she apologize. Zephyr did speak Wednesday ahead of the censure vote.
And when the Speaker asks me to apologize, what he is, on behalf of decorum, what he is really asking me to do is be silent when my community is facing bills that get us killed. He is asking me to be complicit in this legislature's eradication of our community, and I refuse to do so, and I will always refuse to do so.
Tune into Democracy Now! Friday when Representative Zoe Zephyr will join us on the show along with Tennessee State Representative Justin Jones. Elsewhere, North Dakota signed a new law that bans transgender people from using public bathrooms or locker rooms that align with their gender identity. In Missouri, a judge has temporarily blocked harsh new restrictions on gender-affirming care in response to a legal challenge by the ACLU of Missouri and others. And the U.S. Justice Department has sued Tennessee over its law banning gender-affirming care for minors. In Florida, Disney's suing Republican Governor Ron DeSantis for taking control of its self-governing district around the Disney World theme park, accusing DeSantis of, quote, targeted campaign of government retaliation in response to Disney's opposition to Florida's anti-LGBTQ so-called Don't Say Gay law. Meanwhile, Disney has begun laying off thousands more workers this week, including employees of Disney properties ABC News and ESPN. The company has laid off some 4,000 workers since last month. And here in New York, E. Jean Carroll took the stand Wednesday in her civil lawsuit against Donald Trump for battery and defamation, telling a court, quote, I'm here because Donald Trump raped me. Carroll has accused Trump of raping her in a department store dressing room in the 90s and subsequently accusing her of lying about it. Carroll told jurors, quote, he lied and shattered my reputation, and I'm here to try and get my life back, unquote. The judge in the case warned Trump may have engaged in jury tampering for posting on his Truth Social site that the case was a, quote, made-up scam and a witch hunt. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Welcome, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with American historian and political commentator Paul Street on the recent indictment of Donald Trump.
Our interview will include a discussion of what this historian means when he refers to the United States as a Christian nationalist nation. We'll also speak with attorney Noel Hanrahan on the latest court attempts to free the political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
To our great disappointment, the judge ruled against Mumia, but it's not over yet.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Ex-President Donald Trump was indicted 3 weeks ago in New York City by progressive prosecutor Alvin Bragg on 34 separate counts for paying hush money to two women before the 2020 election. The charges are serious and provable. These are the first. There will likely be three even more serious indictments in other jurisdictions. Although Trump looks like the Republican nominee for 2024 presidential election, the accumulation of charges against him will both narrow but harden, invigorate, and mobilize his political support. Trump is the most prominent figure in what has quite accurately been described as an American version of fascism called white Christian nationalism. These forces have captured half the state houses in the country, many courts, and many local governments, all the way down to school boards. Bertolt Brecht, the great German playwright and political thinker, observed during the rise of Hitler and fascism in Germany that in order to understand fascism, you must understand capitalism from which it springs. Under a viral form of capitalism known as neoliberalism, inequality of wealth has reached enormous proportions. Half the population of our country are poor or near poor. Healthcare, education, and housing go a-begging, with 15 million people about to lose their health care and hundreds of thousands of people sleeping on the streets. Sections of the American working class are fighting back. Workers are organizing in Amazon and Starbucks. 9,000 workers won a recent strike at Rutgers University. Polls show that most working people would like to be in a union. But Americans are fighting back with one hand tied behind their backs. They have no independent working class party that defends their interests. Both the Republican and the Democratic parties are corporate capitalist parties. In fact, last year, the Democratic Party received more massive dark money than the Republicans. Fascism is characteristically anti-worker, anti-democratic, racist, nationalistic, misogynist, and violent. It is irrational. It believes in a make-believe past when America was once great. We speak today with historian and political commentator Paul Street on white Christian nationalism, Trump, and fascism, what it is and how to fight it. Paul Street has written 10 books, most recently, This Happened Here, Neoliberals, Americaners, and the Trumping of America. He wrote The Introduction to Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA, co-edited by Law & Disorder co-host, myself, Michael Stephen Smith. He writes regularly for Counterpunch magazine and the Paul Street Report on Substack. Paul Street, welcome back to Law & Disorder.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Paul, you call the Republican Party's reaction to the hush money indictment of Trump unhinged. In what way do you think it was unhinged?
Well, to begin. Now, you know, bear in mind for me, this is the Republic Fascist Party now, and that means they're unhinged on just about everything, right? Windmills, water-saving toilets. Tucker Carlson had a meltdown about M&M logos because they got rid of high heels or something. I remember... I remember any number of insane meltdowns about the tiniest little things when Obama was in the White House. I remember them calling the George Floyd Rebellion a communist, a black nationalist, Marxist-Leninist revolution. So unhinged sort of goes with the turf. Now, the unhinged reaction to the first indictments of Trump and, you know, the indictments on arguably the least of his crimes, maybe we'll talk about that later, you know, it's really sort of extraordinary. He has called this distinguished Manhattan district attorney, Alvin Bragg, a Soros-backed animal. He has said that indictments of him, which he knew were brewing before they came, he said they will lead to death and destruction, and World War III, and Civil War. He went in the lead-up to the indictment we knew was coming to Waco, of all places, and promised to his frenzied followers that he will be their retribution, their vengeance, you know, as we approach the final battle, you know, in 2024. That's Armageddon language. So there's that kind of stuff, which is fairly standard from Trump. But we've had pretty much most of the Republican establishment lining up with this narrative that an attempt, a rather elementary attempt, to indict, arraign Trump on hush money campaign finance case, calling that the radical left political weaponization of government, and this has been sort of across the board. Even Mike Pence, who Donald Trump arguably tried to get hanged on January 6th, has been defending Trump against radical left, you know, way out there, super liberal political weaponization. And now we have Jim Jordan, the very right wing head of the House Judiciary Committee, actually threatening, somehow he thought he could threaten to defund Alvin Bragg, which is really funny because Bragg is a state employee, calling for really sort of a remarkable call for investigations, for federal investigations of a state level district attorney, really sort of violating core Federalist principles in that regard. And now recently holding, I don't know if he's still holding, hearings, congressional hearings in New York City to accuse Bragg of being weak on crime at the same time that he's supposedly engaged in, you know, a communist political weaponization assault on the great virtuous Donald Trump.
Let's talk a bit more about the nature of the Republican Party. You've labeled it as a Christian white nationalist party. How would you describe that? How do you? What is your full meaning about that? Is this simply a form of American fascism?
Yeah, I think it's fair to call it a form of American fascism. I've used, actually, I'm more identified with using the phrase fascism. I would consider the Christian white nationalism, which is a phrase that's starting to show up in academic literature as a description of the Republican Party. I think it's sort of accurate. I think the Christian white nationalism, particularly the Christian emphasis, really brings home the distinctive American aspects of this 21st century neo-fascism. It's a strong, particularly in the American context, it's a little different in Europe. There's a big emphasis on fundamentalist Christianity. White nationalism, on the other hand, is shared across Europe and America. I suppose even aspects of Brazilian and other nations. Fascism. So I mean fascism. And, you know, when I say fascism, it's a complicated topic, can't get into completely here. I would like listeners to know that I wrote a book called This Happened Here. It's all about the Trump administration. But, you know, briefly, with fascism, and yeah, I would sort of subsume American Christian white nationalism within fascism. You have a kind of sense of a betrayed, stabbed in the back, once great nation that needs to be made great again, you know, and this is not unlike what you can read about in the Third Reich and in Hitler's Mein Kampf, right? This stabbed in the back nation. You have an othering, a demonization of racial minorities and intellectuals and feminists and others. You have a eliminationism, political eliminationism, where you want to essentially wipe out and even sort of exterminate any political opposition. You have a cult of personality typically under fascism around an always male maximalist leader. You have, I mean, I could go on. You have an assault on intellectuals. You have a hostility towards independent media, but really critical is political violence. An open embrace of political violence, a readiness to use force, and frankly, a readiness to abandon, and I think this is critical, abandon previously normative bourgeois democracy and rule of law. And we saw that, obviously. You know, a lot of the fascism deniers in this country really had to shut up after January 6th, right? This was an open, putschist attempt. It involved paramilitaries, openly encouraged by Trump and his putschist inner circle, to prevent the peaceful transfer of power from one capitalist party to another. Clearly the GOP, with January 6th, had crossed into a very, very different space than the previously normative bourgeois democratic thing. And he had remarkable things like Trump, as we find out in the Select Committee hearings on January 6th, wanting the metal detectors taken down. This is one of the things that really struck me from that committee, from its findings. Take down the metal detectors because the guys with the AR-15s don't want to hurt me. I'll never forget, no, but people don't notice this enough, or mention it enough, or remember it enough, where Trump went on the last night of the 2020 presidential election. He went to Kenosha, Wisconsin, where Kyle Rittenhouse, a sort of teen white nationalist fascist, had shot down and killed Black Lives Matter protesters. The governor of Texas has just announced that he's, or recently announced, that he's going to pardon a white army sergeant who shot down and was convicted by a jury of his peers in Austin, Texas, and he shot down a Black Lives Matter protester in Austin, Texas in July of 2020. So, I think that there is a crossing over. Estimates vary, 20 to 25% of the population, and people say, well, that's not very many. That's less than a quarter. You know, about a quarter, fifth to a quarter. Some people go up to 30%, but they have this outsized voice in American politics because of gerrymandering, because of the way our primaries elections are structured, because of how the Senate is apportioned with two senators for every state, regardless of the size of the population. Outsized also because of the Electoral College, which, like the way we apportion the Senate, is significantly biased towards the most revanchist, reactionary, white and rural parts of the country. The fascist components of America, Republic fascists, Christian white nationalists, heavily identified with red states, with Republican-controlled states, and then the non-fascist parts of the country with the blue states, but that's a bit deceptive. Illinois is a blue state, but rural Illinois feels every bit as right-wing, as Christian white nationalist to me, as does rural Iowa. Iowa City, a campus town within Iowa, is every bit as blue and liberal. In fact, even feels more that way to me when I'm there than Chicago does. The division isn't just red states, blue states. It's rural, largely rural, versus metropolitan areas and versus cities. The blue America is bi-coastal and metropolitan, and the coasts are more metropolitan than the inland part of the country. Now, there is a significant right-wing cohort in the suburbs, and particularly in the exurbs, and some of the sociological research on who attacked the Capitol on January 6th was sort of interesting. Many of these guys, and it was mostly guys, came from metropolitan suburbs that had been undergoing white to non-white racial transition, and they felt threatened by that. But in terms of class, for example, it's really all strata. It's contrary to some of the narratives that you hear. This fascist base, a Republic fascist base, is not particularly proletarian. There are proletarians in it. It's actually a bit more affluent than the Democratic base. It's sort of disproportionately petty bourgeois. You hear a lot that it's the non-college educated, and that's very true, but oftentimes not having a college degree is over-conflated with being in the working class. Actually, there's plenty of affluent people in small businesses and in the trades and elsewhere without college degrees. But yes, that's a big signifier, not having a college degree. But more than socioeconomic status, what really seems to predict lining up with Trump and Trumpism or DeSantis in Florida, you know, is a kind of a grieved sense of whiteness and maleness and a belief that quote-unquote European values are under attack and need to be defended by, you know, any means necessary.
I wonder, Paul Street, what is the difference between what you've called bourgeois democracy in the United States and fascism?
Yeah, well, of course, now bourgeois democracy isn't just me. That's a longstanding term in Marxist. When you go through that list of things that I would say are characteristic of fascism, neo-fascism, Christian white nationalism, if some prefer, they don't have those. The people in the bourgeois democratic camp, which is largely the Democratic Party, really don't have those characteristics. And, you know, just to sort of concretize it a little bit, and it is very much about GOP versus Dems, and in some ways a kind of civil war within the elite and within the broader populace that is largely traces along the lines of Republicans versus Democrats. But, you know, Al Gore, having the election stolen from him in 2000-2001 and not fighting back about it and pretty much handing over power, and, you know, obsequiously bowing to the tradition of peaceful transfer of power, right, in 2001 versus Donald Trump in 2020 and 2021, where he simply refuses to accept a loss, creates a gigantic Leviathan lie, a big lie that Goebbels and Hitler would have envied, that the election was stolen from him, and prepares to create a state of emergency that he hopes will after trying to cripple the election, crafts a sloppy but nonetheless menacing putsch attempt to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. Imagine Obama losing in 2012 to Romney and trying to call his supporters to in armed military fashion to Washington, D.C. to prevent Romney. So, you know, the Democrats are clinging. As the Republicans are shredding bourgeois democracy, the Democrats are clinging desperately, one might argue, to its last remnants, and insist on everything being very peaceful. They're very reluctant to call people into the streets for anything ever. The fascist party, the one that's crossed over into that, is not reluctant to do that. I mean, we've seen this on the abortion issue, the willingness to just rely on lobbying and rely on judges, and she just hope the Supreme Court won't do that. We just hope the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals won't wipe out Mifepristone. We hope, you know, I mean, you've seen this on NBC right now. Well, we just gotta hope that the Supreme Court allows the leading medication abortion bill in this country to survive. And if it doesn't, by God, we'll show them at the ballot box in 2024, right? Never mind that right now the Republic fascists have a case before the Supreme Court called Moore v. Harper that, among other things, carried to its extreme, might actually make it possible for red states to state legislatures to cancel the popular presidential votes in their states if they don't like which way they go.
Paul Street, why do you write that the fascism stalking our country is far bigger than Donald Trump?
You know, a lot of these core characteristics, the willingness to demonize racial others, the readiness to craft political and policy strategies to eliminate your opposition, to suppress votes, to gerrymander the other party, gerrymandered almost completely out of existence, the distribution of weapons, which is a really key part firearms, which is a really key part of the fascist agenda. A lot of these things precede Trump. They precede the Trump presidency. The Trump phenomena, they will follow in his wake. If he died tomorrow, they would not go away. They would find new leaders. Ron DeSantis, who's fading a little bit lately because Trump's getting a kind of wind from the indictment that in New York. But Ron DeSantis would pick it up, and many of the same funders and the backers in the base might very well just congeal onto DeSantis, who in some ways is arguably a more dangerous because less buffoonish and less clownish and more intelligent and just flat-out lethal fascist than Trump is, and I think a much more of a truly dedicated ideologue of white nationalism DeSantis is. And in fact, he's turning his state. We don't have time to do Florida now, but he's turning all of it, but he's turning his state into arguably the leading fascist laboratory, not just in the country, but very possibly in the world right now. And that leads me to mention the states. There's a lot of over-focus in the mainstream political commentary on the Republican Party on the clowns and the wreckers and the buffoons like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar and Boebert and, of course, Trump himself. And they don't seem to have, they do actually, but they don't seem to have a coherent intellectual ideological framework. Go down to the state level. It's as serious as a heart attack in Missouri, in Iowa, in red state America. And there is a dedicated slew of objectively neo-fascist policy and legislation that is just being churned out in state legislatures and governor's office. Vote suppression, the wiping out of the accurate teaching of American history, the whitewashing of racism and sexism, gay bashing, and all of that. It's really quite dramatic, and the states are just moving ahead, even as we have one mass shooting after another. There were five mass shootings on Saturday. States are moving ahead with bills to make guns more accessible and less regulated. DeSantis just signed a bill that takes away background checks for concealed carry. There's a similar bill that's just been that is moving through the Missouri House. I mean, I could go on and on. And now there's this massive assault on transgendered youth and transgendered people in general across red state America. And of course, the fascists also, in a very dedicated, non-buffoonish, and quite serious Leninist kind of dedicated way, are all over the federal court system. It's one of Trump's great fascist accomplishments, and also Mitch McConnell's, was just to proliferate all these Federalist Society people, right?
Yeah, Paul, so let's talk then a bit more about fascism and what historically we've learned perhaps about how to fight it. What social forces, for example, need to be, well, brought together and organized and way to combat fascism? How would you describe that battle and how it can perhaps best be won? What's required if we are going to win it?
Any and all people who support humanity, who are interested in humanity and democracy and social justice. I'm not, I come from a Marxist background, but at a certain point I get tired of this constant invocation of the working classes. The working class this, and the working class that. Now, we need women, we need intellectuals, people from any and all classes. I'm not puritanical about bourgeois people. They need their money. You know, we need folks. Refuse Fascism, on whose editorial board I sit, wanted a Puerto Rican-style mass rebellion. We wanted Trump removed after his election. We wanted him removed Mario Savio style, by people putting their bodies on the gears of the machine. Incidentally, that's the same perspective we have about abortion rights. We're tired of this language that we'll just have to wait and see what the courts say, and we'll show them at the ballot box. By God, one day we'll have a Rovember and we'll vote all these people out. You know, Biden's promise, he'll totally ridiculous promise that he'll sign a bill that makes Roe v. Wade national law. Not a chance in hell of ever doing that, the way the Senate is set up and the way the Senate is portioned. Right? So really, anybody and everybody that is down with that is ready to come out into the streets and in the public squares and in the broader culture, and as we say in the streets, shut stuff down to make it very clear. Now, of course, labor should strike, you know, and unions. There should be political involvement. We're coming up on May Day, the real workers' holiday. And, you know, we're going to need everybody on board who doesn't want to live under an authoritarian regime, which we really could have, a fully authoritarian, a consolidated authoritarian regime after 2024-25. The Democrats are much more vulnerable in the Senate races. We only have two parties in our bourgeois system, and the presidential elections are pretty much always a coin flip. And actually, they're tilted a little bit to the right because of the way the Electoral College is set up. And they have the judiciary. They have a lion's share of the judiciary now, the right wing does. So we could theoretically be looking at triple branch, consolidated, what I call republic fascist power. And we're going to need to be ready to engage in serious mass nonviolent action. Voting will not be enough. Voting will not be enough. Number two, fascism, having failed to remove Trump, Puerto Rican style, yes, we thought it was essential given the space that continues to exist under merely bourgeois democracy. It's important. It's not irrelevant. The space that exists to still be able to organize. You know, there are issues that you could say are bigger than the problem of fascism, like ecocide. It's the biggest issue humanity has ever faced. It's the biggest issue of any of all or any times. However, there's no chance whatsoever of taking on the climate catastrophe under white nationalist authoritarian rule. You can just forget about it, right? You remember how Standing Rock just shut down? That great rebellion in late Obama just disappeared once Trump came in, because people knew that meant that live ammunition, right? Live ammunition versus cattle prods. There's a difference there.
Paul Street, ultimately, isn't it a question of leadership And how do you see this coming about?
I'm not saying this couldn't come from within the political class. I actually once heard in Iowa City, I heard Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez actually say, she's actually said fascism a couple of times. She had to be pressed to do it, but she said it. And I've also heard her say, like I just indicated in Iowa City, no, Coralville, Iowa, said that she wasn't sure that electoral politics was the way to go. I'm sort of struck by that. I mean, in an election cycle, in an election occurrence, saying electoral politics is inevitable. She's right. You know, she's really right about that. We need leadership that points out that there is a politics in the streets and the public squares and in the broader culture and in the offices and in the schools, you name it, beneath and beyond these little holy electoral extravaganza moments where once every 2 or 4 years we make little marks next to the name of candidates who have been selected in advance for us, the ruling class. Yes, it matters to have a non-fascist, an FDR in there, or instead of a fascist in there, of course. But after those 2 minutes that it takes to mark that ballot, what are you doing? You know, that's really the politics that matters the most. We need leadership. I think of Occupy and a lot of the anarchists I've known who deny the need for leadership. Frankly, part of why Occupy collapsed as quickly as it did, and who actually are against anything in the way of a vanguard, you know, because then that's just the new authoritarian power, and they actually say they don't want to take and use state power. Well, the right wing wants to take and use state power. We want state power. We want that. Ultimately, we need to really take aim at the underlying socioeconomic system that makes fascism even appear in the first place, and that is, in fact, capitalism, imperialism. I'm sorry, but we do need vanguards. We do need to take state power, and we need to wield it in an effective way to keep fascist counter-revolutionaries at bay. Now, who that vanguard is, you know, that's a very contested issue, and unfortunately, we've got about 85 different left variants of who the vanguard is. I have a lot of friends in the Revolutionary Communist Party. I think that a lot of what they do is really actually very important. They catch a lot of grief, and I always say to folks, well, then make something better if you've got something better to make. And by the way, all the 58,000 different varieties of seriously left radical groups really need to think about healing some of their sectarian divisions and coming together, because, you know, it just, after a while, it just looks ridiculous. You're 65th different branch off Trotskyist sect arguing with the 63rd and the 62nd Trotskyist sect and the 42nd anarcho-Maoist sect. After a while, it just becomes a Monty Python skit.
But Paul, how can our listeners find out more about your writings, have access to those writings, follow your work? What would you suggest?
I'm right now doing 2 essays a week, usually, and sometimes an audio on Substack, and that's called the Paul Street Report. It's called the Paul Street Report. I have a website, so paulstreet.org, where I'm a little behind with it right now, but where I post most of my pieces. And I'm most Fridays through Sundays, I have a piece on Counterpunch. And I have an author, if you Google my name and plus Counterpunch, you'll come right up to my author page.
It's been really good talking to you. Thanks again for being on Law and Disorder.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
American political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal has served over 40 years in Pennsylvania's harshest prisons, 16 of them on death row, for the murder of a Philadelphia police officer that he did not commit. His trial was a sham from day one. The judge who convicted him was overheard promising, and I quote, "I'm going to help fry the N-word," close quote. Before Mumia's conviction, he was a nationally broadcast, award-winning radio journalist and the head of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. He reported on the murderous racial violence of the Philadelphia Police Department and its notorious police chief and later mayor, Frank Rizzo. Mumia had been a member of the Philadelphia chapter of the Black Panther Party. Now, while in prison, Mamiya has written 13 books and had a weekly radio show, Live from Death Row. He holds a master's degree and is working on a PhD in history. Most recently, Mamiya's attorneys have sought a new trial for him based on their discovery of exculpatory evidence clearly supporting his innocence. This newly discovered evidence had been wrongly kept from Mamiya's lawyers at the time of his trial, being deliberately buried, if you will, in the prosecutor's files. This evidence documented that key witnesses had received promises of money and favorable treatment in their own criminal cases in exchange for their perjured testimony in Mamiya's original trial. The petition also documented the unconstitutional practice of striking black jurors during Mamiya's original trial. But sadly, despite the obvious significance of this newly discovered evidence, his petition for a new trial has been denied. Well, to help us understand this ongoing massive denial of justice for Mamiya Abu-Jamal, we speak today with Pennsylvania attorney Noelle Hanrahan. She is a longtime supporter of Mamiya and the producer of the long-running radio show Prison Radio. She was in the courtroom when the newly discovered evidence was presented in support of Mamiya's petition for a trial, and again when it was recently denied. Noelle Hanrahan, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
You know, you know Mamiya Abu-Jamal very well. Talk about your relationship with him and what you've learned as a result of that. What is he like? What have some of his accomplishments have been?
Mamiya is a really warm and generous guy, and I feel like we're colleagues. We're radio producers, we're radio hosts, that's where we got our start. Mamiya got his start in the black newsroom in the late 70s and 80s, and then he became a rising star with William Bill Zimmering being his mentor, and Zimmering started All Things Considered. And so Mamiya was on WHYY as a reporter, and he was going to be the next Ed Bradley. So he really is a very talented, very gregarious, really funny guy. Like, Mamiya is so funny. But he's also serious. So he's fluent in French, fluent in German. He's conversational in Spanish. He just finished his French comps for his PhD. He's working on his comprehensive exams, and he's starting to write his dissertation. So he's an amazing and accomplished person who kept being a journalist, kept going, even though he was taken out of his community, arrested in 1981 on December 9th, and has spent his entire rest of his life after he was 26 in prison. He'll be 69 in April 24th, and he continues. He's really committed to being with us and trying to reach us and trying to be part of the community and be part of the solution.
How would you describe the forces aligned against Mamiya?
So Mamiya, when he was a journalist in Philadelphia, was exposing Frank Rizzo. Frank Rizzo was the mayor and also the police commissioner. And he had a way of dominating the Philadelphia community. And it was very jackboot, very fascist. And Mamiya was right there at press conferences demanding accountability. He was a courageous investigative reporter using his microphone and his access to the airwaves to absolutely put the bright, white, hot spotlight on corruption. They did not like that, so they targeted Mamiya in many, many different ways. And so who's allied against him? The Fraternal Order of Police, which is a fraternal organization, an akin to a union, but not really. You know, 12,000 members. Right now it has retired police officers and also other, you know, current police officers, 6,500 police officers in the city of Philadelphia. The majority of those police officers are white. They have very little education, and for many years, decades, they have been using poor and marginalized communities, the African American community, as a source of income, literally. Like, when they Larry Krasner said it in the Atlantic magazine, the key problem in Philadelphia for the last number of decades and over incarceration has been police overtime. And so they arrest people, they go to court the next day, and they get the overtime bump. Honestly, I asked one of our council persons, legislative director, Kenyatta Johnson's legislative director, what's the issue here? And he said, oh no, it's the police. They have to pay for their Jersey mortgages and they have to get their pension bump in the last 3 years. So they over arrest people who are not able to fight back. This is an assembly line. Everyone knows that there are false arrest reports. Now, how does this say that these people are arrayed against Mumia? It's journalists with integrity, like Mumia Abu-Jamal, who would be willing to hold these people accountable. That's why they call it the Fifth Estate. That's why the First Amendment and the right of the press is so integral to our country. It's because there have to be ways in which the community is able to hold police and prosecutors accountable. They wanted him out of the way, and they targeted him.
Explain to us and to our audience, more importantly, what kind of support Mumia has, you know, locally, nationally, and internationally. I've often made the claim that he's understood to be internationally to be a political prisoner and so forth. Is there truth to that? Is his case well known around the country and the world?
So one of the things that happened with Mumia that he was really buried for the first 10 or 11 years, like he had one or two articles, he had some things that he was doing, but when he went to prison, he was denied visits, he was denied phone calls, and he was isolated. That was for the first decade. Then he published an article in the Yale Law Journal after about 8 or 9 years, and he started to be reaching out to people and being able to reach some people. At that moment, I heard a scratchy tape of him, and I heard about his case. One of the ways that I heard about his case was I was in touch with a political prisoner who was in Holmesburg prison with Mumia, and that community of political prisoners, the white imperialists, Alan Berkman, a doctor, he was incarcerated with Mumia for a moment, and he kept talking about him. So there was this echo chamber of the Linda Evanses, the Alan Berkmans, the other prisoners kept talking about their person inside who was facing execution. So facing execution then also dramatically increased Mumia's visibility. So he was began to reach out again, began to be doing much more in terms of journalism. The vibe around him was growing. The death penalty is an anathema to the international community. It's like very rare, and so there's a worldwide movement against it. So he became someone who they were talking about internationally. I heard about him. I was at KPFA Radio, Pacifica Station, and we were covering the Robert Alton Harris execution in 1992, which was when California was bringing back the death penalty, the first execution in 25 years. And so when we were covering that, I was a news reporter there, looking for voices from death row to speak. And I couldn't get any from San Quentin, even though we could literally see San Quentin from our Berkeley studios. But I heard Mumia's tape, and I went to visit him. I put a microphone in front of him, and it was the first recording he'd done for radio in 11 years. And when I did that in July of 1992, I realized that Mumia literally was James Earl Jones in a box. He had this immense talent. He was the most professional person I'd ever recorded, and I'd been doing hundreds of interviews by then. He started his interview, first time he's ever done a recording in 10 years, with 1, 2, 3, mark. He gave me space for the edits. He was a professionally trained journalist with...
Why did Mumia's supporters say that his initial trial was racist?
So Mumia was tried in front of a man named Albert F. Szabo, who has sent the most people to death row of any sitting judge ever in the United States. Many of them have, his cases have been overturned. They say it was racist because there was a court reporter, the documentation of how racist it was. There was a court reporter who was assigned to his chambers, and they were in the hallway, and she was standing with another sitting judge, Judge Klein. And Szabo came up to both of them, and Terry Morita Carter has stated in an affidavit, Albert Szabo said, in the first week of the trial, I am going to help them fry the N-word. He was talking about Mumia, and that was the judge that Mumia had throughout this case. Now, Pamela Demby is another PCRA judge, current judge, head of the Library Commission in Philadelphia for many years, and she reviewed this affidavit by Terry Moore Carter, award-winning court stenographer, not related to the movement, produced this affidavit. It was witnessed by another sitting judge, and she said she's reviewed all of Albert Szabo's original rulings in the trial, and she found that none of them were tainted by racial bias. So therefore, the statement overheard by Terry Morita Carter meant that none of the decisions were materially affected by the judge's bias.
It's extraordinary. No, I know. It's extraordinary, and there's more to it. If we had more time, we would talk about that as well. It's just extraordinary. But I wonder, describe for our audience this newly discovered evidence, exculpatory evidence, really, that was the basis for his recent petition for a new trial. Why wasn't it turned over originally to Mumia's lawyers at the time of his original trial? And how was it found now?
So there's, you know, the Brady doctrine of the United States Supreme Court that any material evidence, exculpatory evidence that should be turned over to the defense that could be used to either impeach a witness or to prove innocence or to inform the defense counsel about the nature of the evidence against him. Anything that's potentially revelatory, that's potentially helpful, absolutely has to be turned over. Now, that has been watered down so that the courts really don't hold the prosecution accountable for turning over that material. But there comes time when you find documents buried in storage locker number 17, as this one was, that are smoking guns. And once you have that document, and this document was Robert Chovert, a cab driver, said in a note written down, sent to the Assistant District Attorney Jack McGill after the trial was over, I've been trying to reach you. You said you were on vacation. You said to get back to me, and I want to know where my money is, where his payment was. And so we needed to be able to bring Robert Chovert in and ask him what he was thinking. We also need to bring in Mr. McGill and say, what promises did you make? Now, on the record, this witness, Robert Chovert, he was promised help with getting his license back, because this was a cab driver who said that he was parked behind Officer Faulkner's cab and that he saw the shooting and he saw Mumia shoot the officer. Now, later on, photos came out. The first photos on the scene from the Philadelphia Bulletin, they came out but were disallowed by the court. They said they were turned in too late, that they did violated the 60-day rule. They weren't found and produced within 60 days of the defense knowing about them. These proved that the guy's cab was not there. There was no cab 10 minutes after the scene. There was no cab where Robert Chovert said he was. So he was on probation, and he didn't have a license to drive a cab, and the DA promised that he would help him get the driver's license back. That's on the record. What also didn't get put in the record is that he was on probation for throwing a Molotov cocktail into a school for pay. That was never presented to the jury. So now we have him asking where was his money. Now, the DA said, oh, it was bus money, lunch money, money for work. Well, we've proven that it wasn't money for work. It wasn't bus money. It wasn't lunch money. It wasn't the per diem. So, but the court in this case, in Mumia's case right now, that note said, even if the key witnesses, one and two, another witness, Cynthia White, were bribed, that would not have changed the one juror's decision in this case, that it wasn't material. So the Brady evidence can be unconstitutionally prevented from being given to the defense, but it also has to be material. And being material means that it has to have affected at least one juror. And our judge, Lucretia Clemens, in this case, this month, decided that bribing witnesses was not materially affecting the jury's decision.
Yeah, that's incredible. She'll go far. Despite the clearly exculpatory nature of the newly found evidence, the court nevertheless still denied his petition for a new trial. Why did the judge say the petition was being denied?
She said that even if we could prove that Cynthia White, a prostitute in the case, was given favorable treatment throughout the rest of her career, that it wouldn't have mattered to the jury. And the same she said of that there was additional evidence. Now, the additional evidence was a confession that they say they got from Lumia, which has major problems but has not yet been able to be challenged. So part of the Brady problem is that you look at every piece of evidence individually and you don't have enough of a way to look at it cumulatively. Like, for instance, there is a false confession in this case. So 3 months after the incident in March, the ADA, Jack McGill, calls in all the police officers and the security guard at the hospital and says, "Did anyone hear a confession?" And they raised their hands and said, "Yes." And they said, "We forgot. We were so traumatized that we didn't remember, and we didn't put any police reports at the night of the incident or after that the defendant had confessed on the hospital room floor." So that's one thing. You know, there's all these different pieces of evidence that cumulatively really weaken the case, but that Albert Szabo, the judge we spoke about earlier, allowed in this way. There is another witness, Veronica Jones, that was disallowed by Szabo in 1995. She said she was a prostitute, and she was offered, quote, the same deal as Cynthia White, that she could work for free if she testified against Lumia. He ruled that this witness was not credible, and therefore her testimony was stricken. So what follows Lumia Abu-Jamal into the court is the record. It is a record created by Albert Szabo, and it's a record privileged by the PCRA judge, Pamela Denby, who didn't allow the statement from the court reporter saying, "I'm going to help him fry the N-word." All of that is not in the record. It can't be seen cumulatively. So Judge Clemens could try to convince herself that she's just looking at solid evidence of a confession, solid evidence of two people with an ID, though, in fact, she really can't, because it's transparent. It's transparent. Everyone knows. Everyone in the courthouse knows. Everyone in the courthouse knows that Judge Albert Szabo was the most racist judge. I interviewed Barbara McDermott, a homicide judge who's a current homicide judge. I interviewed her. I went in there, and I talked to her because I got a mentorship from the ABA. And I went in and talked to her, and she goes, "Absolutely, everybody knows. Most homophobic, sexist, racist judge we've ever met. There's no doubt that people know that Lumia Abu-Jamal is innocent of this crime. It's the issue of finality. It's the issue of preservation of this system that has incarcerated a number of generations of Philadelphians who are poor and black. Even our liberal radical DA, Larry Krasner, believes in the system. It can't go too far." So he petitioned the court to winnow down the application of a good ruling for Lumia a couple of years ago just to Lumia and a handful of others, because he didn't want to call into question the entire prosecution. It's the theory that we can't have too much justice, because too much justice would mean that the system itself is rotten to the core. Like, we're revolutionaries. The radical, you know, interpretation is that the system and its issue of finality prevents accountability, that the Juanita Kidd Injustice Center has had an assembly line of black and brown bodies through that system, and that is what they want to preserve. They want to preserve their pensions, their legacy, their investment in the system that has not privileged poor and black people and has privileged the sons of Frank Rizzo.
Yeah, well, indeed, as you well know, the U.S. Supreme Court itself, on behalf of finality, ruled that the mere fact of innocence is not enough to reverse a conviction. But in terms of Mamiya's case, he's clearly a political prisoner. It's clearly been a political case, as you've described. Indeed, there's a, as I say, a worldwide movement that recognizes that, that supports his right to a new trial. But in light of this most recent denial of justice for him, what can that movement or his lawyers next do on behalf of finally freeing Mamiya Abu-Jamal?
You know, this is a law program, right? And I am a lawyer, and I've been an investigator for 20 years as well. But really, honestly, the law and the ability to get relief is 10% of the equation. You have to have fantastic, amazing lawyers, but it's the movement. It's the people. It's the evolving standards of human decency. It's the call for accountability. I believe that Mumia's ability to come home to his people and his family is going to happen, and it's going to be because we have more power. And I think that we need to understand that, that they can make a change, a decision. They can let people out. They can invent a reason. They don't care about their own roles. When they feel like they have to, for political pressure points, to let the safety valve off, they're going to let him out, just like they did for Herman Wallace of the Angola 3. They invented reasons to get that guy popped out of prison before he died in prison, a member of the Angola 3. So we have the power. Now, the other platitude I'm going to say, and it is a platitude, but I believe it. I really believe it. They don't let us know that we're close to winning when we're near winning. They hold on tightest at the very end with, like, their fingernails really grabbing on. They want to hold on. But we are powerful. We are able to mobilize in order to bring our political prisoners home. Russell Maroon Schotz came home. Sunde Ayokoh Lee came home. People are coming home, and we are able to do that. And so it is possible, and Mumia Abu-Jamal, I believe, will be free. What can the lawyers do? We have the best lawyers. Brett Grody of the Abolitionist Law Center is a top-of-the-line abolitionist attorney in Pennsylvania. His counsel from the NAACP legal office is amazing. Samuel Spital clerked for Justice Stevens, Harvard clerked for Stevens. Judith Ritter is a member of the community of the Pennsylvania and Delaware bars. She's great. You know, he has a superb legal team. That is critical. You have to have that. And he will take an appeal. He may do a federal appeal. He may do a state appeal to the Superior Court. Our enemy now is time, because Mumia is 69 years old. I'm sure he will do a commutation. He's got Shapiro, who's the governor of Pennsylvania, in front of him. That's difficult because he has aspirations for presidential opportunities. But there are things that will be in motion. But as I said initially, the power lies in the people. And when they will, when they need to, because of the pressure, they will free him.
Noel, you're at Prison Radio. Tell us about that, and tell us how we can help a political prisoner.
Prison Radio's whole mission is to bring the voices and the humanity of people who are inside prison into the public debate and dialogue, to get them on the airwaves, to privilege their voices. That we don't believe in describing those conditions. We think that the walls are such that we need to overcome them. We need to bring those voices out. So that's what we do with Mumia, our most prolific commentator, but we do it with hundreds of other people all across the country. And we talk about the issues inside, whether it's COVID or trans issues or pre-sentencing detention or everything. We have a vast variety of wonderful people talking about their lives and connecting with communities outside. And that's at www.prisonradio.org. In addition, we often advocate for them. We often advocate for, we were the people who did the lawsuit around hepatitis C for Mumia, getting the first preliminary injunction in the country to get the fast-acting cure for people in prison. And that rolled out to the rest of the country. Right now, we're trying to get cardiac diet care, a healthy diet for Mumia after his cardiac surgery. That's going to roll out to the rest of Pennsylvania, and we're going to win that one. So we advocate for our correspondents, and we connect them with the community. Uhuru called last week, and he said, I just wanted to tell you, Noel, that the reason that I got my sentence commuted and I'm going to be released in 2025 is because people heard my voice on the radio and they connected with me. Two of my main supporters who helped me get clemency came from that connection.
Yeah. It can, in addition to following your work, in fact, if our listeners say, by goodness, I'd like to help with that, how might they do so?
So what happens is, if you gave any amount of money, if you gave a dollar, you'd be on our mailing list for 3 years. And so what that gives you is hard copy postcards, stickers, posters. We send out 6 mailings a year, getting people information about current hearings, about people's cases, beautiful artwork, because we want to make a connection with people. So mailing addresses actually matter, so I can really get people, like the documents and the postcards, and we then can call on people to do a Zap campaign to get people their heart medication, to protest the visiting restrictions. We really can mobilize. We have 14,000 people in our database. We have 3,500 active people. We mostly get $10, $25 from people, and that fuels our ability to keep the connection with them.
In addition to the financial support, of course, what I'm impressed with is how people can also go to your website and become part of the activist community around these issues. And that's what you've laid out for us. And so I would frankly, unashamedly encourage our listeners to do just that. And give that website again.
prisonradio.org.
Well, thank you so much, Noel, for being with us today and for the great work that you do.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Looks down.